There are reports that
we can easily know that, how long do we have? So we're going to go ahead and get started here. And let me just briefly introduce each of the panelists. Actually, I'll start with myself. I'm Tony Parras. I'm the company Second Power. I'm a 20-person software development firm. We build leading edge e-learning e-performance solutions, which is our company. So, Brent? From the center, moving in order according to how we have the list. Brent is now with Hospice of the Valley. He was formerly with Intel. He is in charge of e-learning for Hospice of the Valley, which is a brand new thing for them. So it's interesting, he's going from a large organization with a lot of resources to a small organization and trying to get things to happen grassroots. So they have a pretty interesting perspective on how things happen. From the opposite end of the spectrum, Tony Driscoll. From IBM. Tony looked at kind of, I guess the easiest way to describe it would be leading edge uses of learning and performance and knowledge support across IBM as an organization. He gets involved in sort of some of the more leading edge stuff, which then permeates throughout IBM and also to how IBM works with IBM. And last but certainly not least, Stephen Down. Stephen Downs, folks in the corporate space might be less familiar with, but if you're in educational e-learning, you certainly absolutely know Stephen Downs. He's probably the biggest known blogger out there. Certainly every time he mentions me on his blog, the number of hits I get on my blog goes significantly up. Stephen is a researcher who looks at the use of technology for learning, particularly in more educational settings, I would say. Fair, Stephen?
No.
No? Okay. why don't you?
Just educational applications, very intense stuff.
Okay. And we're going to get quite a diversity of opinions here as we go through the talk. This is quite a visionary group, and so in some ways it's going to be fun just for me to hear what they have to say about a variety of topics. That'll help such a So here's what we are hoping to do today, is just get a variety of perspectives from the panelists and hopefully from the audience about what people are doing, where things are going, and we're trying to look out a little farther. The topics we're going to cover are listed there, and we'll just work through them one at a time, and that's pretty much it. We're going to have to move fairly quickly through them, though, so my job is just to keep things moving and try to keep the pace going. That'll be a constant tension between Stephen and myself. Collectively, we looked through a list of possible topics, and unfortunately, we just based on time, we had to make some choices about what we talked about and what we didn't talk about. So a few things we're not discussing, authoring tools, virtual classroom tools, use of video, alternate platforms. Certainly, there's a lot of interesting things going on relative to each of these topics. We have a lot we want to talk about there, but we just felt like there's more interesting discussions that we have in the other topics, so fortunately, we do. Caveat. These are things we're not going to cover. So let's jump into the first one, which I think is a really interesting topic. For those of you who were in the one-on-one session I did yesterday, looking at kind of what's happening next in e-learning tools, you certainly heard a lot about how there's been this transition from where instructional designers were in charge of everything, building courses, courseware, and longer chunks. And we started to push out the rapid e-learning tools where you might have a subject matter expert being capable of doing more of the production, to even where users or learners can generate content using tools like wikis and blogs or social bookmarking. And so there's this interesting transition going on right now away from the instructional design-centric model. But certainly the percentages, if you look out there at the recent survey work done by the e-learning guild, percentages might look like 60% is still traditional authoring, 39% is rapid authoring approaches, including some subject matter expert generated, and 1% is use of these more advanced tools and learner generated content, but still a very small percentage. But certainly I think that all of us share the opinion that things seem to be moving in that direction and we need to get a little ahead of it. Now, what I was hoping to do is just kind of throw it to the panelists, and maybe Brent, actually, if you could start it out and talk a little bit about your experience with the Intel history course and kind of what happened there. And maybe you could slide the microphone a little closer so I'm sure everybody can hear.
Are they working?
Sort of.
Yeah. Okay. So, this is probably one of my favorite stories about the wisdom of the crowds and where we gather content from. And sorry, my voice is getting crackled because I lost it last night after speaking all day. So I'll do the best I can. But we had, for several years back, there's always been an initiative to create some sort of e-learning for new employees on the history of Intel products. So new engineers coming into the field have a better understanding of why we are at where we are at today and how we got there from different products. Because a lot of that is not taught in the school. The latest and greatest technologies get taught, and they come to Intel, and they're not exactly sure why we do things the way they do them. So historically, all of the different technologies, everyone's been wanting in all of the different organizations to create an historical course on that. And so we traditionally would look at what it would cost to put something like this together in the traditional e-learning fashion of an actual course with all of the media. And sometimes it ran up, some of the quotes we got ran up into the hundreds of thousands of dollars and 18-month media design process, things like that. The project over time would always dwindle out and die. As soon as Intel started this sort of organic growth of wikis, a couple guys in IT started turned on a media wiki installation and called it Intelpedia. It was kind of taken from Wikipedia. And it just started to grow and grow and grow. And somebody along the line started a page called History of Intel. And what we got at the end of the day was an absolutely fabulous chronological list. It was sectioned off by year that people had put things in. Everybody was going into their own personal archives. These are senior engineers from way back, even retired engineers that still had access to the network, were taking old photographs of themselves with some of the top guys back in the early days and the products that they took of the products that they created and uploading those to the wiki and typing in personal experiences of how they created certain products. And so at the end of the day, what you have is this very beautifully well-organized chronological history of coming right directly from the folks that lived it, which is 100 times more powerful than anything I, as an instructional designer, or anybody else could have designed. So at the end of the day, it costs nothing for us to create this thing that is now this incredible archive of content that if we wanted to not have everybody go through and read this whole thing, we could now pull out chunks that we thought were really key, very important ones, and then create an e-learning course from that.
That's really cool. Stephen, what kind of things are you seeing out there in terms of where learner-generated content is taking off and having real impact?
Well, how do I want to put that? Because I don't get to look inside company firewalls like she does, so I don't have any Intel stories. But first thing that I think about when I hear that Intel story is, well, why don't they share it? Mm-hmm. Why is it internal? The main thing that I'm seeing, to be honest with you, it's an awful lot of walls. I see walls at Intel, I see walls at Yahoo, I see walls at Microsoft. And so out there in the wild world, what you're seeing is mostly an awful lot of individual efforts. People like, say, Juan Cole, who's an authority on the Middle East and does a Middle East blog. Or people like Jeff Jarvis, who writes a media blog. Authorities in their own particular subject who feel strongly about their subject and write about or blog about or create video about that particular topic. I wanted to say video because it was one of the things you said we're not talking about. I want to get to the ball lit last year.
So I guess one thing though that's striking me is that it used to be that in corporate e-learning, we felt pretty sure that we were always on the leading edge of where things were at. And now, then there was kind of like academia and consumer behind us. Nowadays, I would say consumers are often way out in front, and then academia, and then we're behind. Because I see a lot more use of wikis and blogs in academia these days than I do. And it seems like it's taking off tremendously in especially higher ed spaces. Is that your sense as well?
No, that's my sense. A lot of these technologies are being developed either in the consumer or environment or more frequently an academic environment. You talk about media with you, from Media Lab, of course. I remember way back when I was first getting involved in this, actually I was involved in something called MUD, multi-user dungeons, or domains, as we renamed them, because you can't really plug a dungeon in a college. We had our own, but I also used to take part in something called Media Move. And Move is a type of MUD, and it was also done by Media Lab. So, and, you know, things like wikis, things like blogs, not so much the corporate context, more the personal context. The corporate world actually came up with RSS and abandoned it. They thought it had no value. Netscape and Microsoft had the CDF, I forget what it was, Common Definition Format or something like that, and Netscape came up with RSS, and Microsoft said, CDF, nah, they'll never use it. Netscape just turfed and just dropped the format entirely, and it was just rescued by people who just got together on mailing lists and discussion groups and kept the format alive over a number of years, and eventually attached it to these weird little things there where people were putting diaries and journals online, and they were just using web pages, and it was so awkward. We attached RSS to these things, and all of a sudden we had blogging.
Yeah, and it's interesting to hear that you're seeing the pockets of adoption with kind of a bottom-up adoption model of these technologies. That certainly seems to be the case in corporate space as well as in academia. Tony, why don't you talk a little bit about like the industry wiki and some of the experience you've got at IBM?
Yeah, and I take Stephen to heart on his point that there's too many walls, right? So, for instance, in the blogging context, I think IBM's been really thoughtful about, you know, 350,000 people, it's like, well, what do? We let them have a blog, yes or no, should it be inside or outside? And the idea is you choose. So I personally have chosen to have an external blog, a blog outside the firewall, and they gave 10 very simple guidelines, which I have posted on my blog, which is, hey, yes, I'm a corporate dude, but I also have a brain, and I can think, you know, larger than within my firewall, but here's the guidelines that IBM has provided me to do that. So if I think about the web in general, it's kind of like web 1.0 was the democratization of access. It means all of us out here through a browser can get at stuff. And banks thought that was cool because you could get at your banking records and then they can maybe charge you for transactions and that kind of thing. But the model of democratization of access was about user accessing centrally controlled content, whether that content was banking records or somebody's course or whatever it was. It was kind of like we had this access channel now that allowed us to do it. I think the inflection point of Web 2.0 or whatever it is you want to call it is this notion of democratization of participation and the read-write web. We are now not just consumers of what other people create. We are contributors to it, and tools like wikis or blogs allow that personalized expertise to become rendered. The issue with it that we're seeing at IBM, because blogging is taking hold very strongly, there's been a story that I think is a bit apocryphal, but there's a story that one of our tech guys, and we have a lot of tech guys and people, I should say, that his blog got hit more than IBM's homepage went down. So as an HR guy, I thought, who is that dude, and let's block him in. I don't even know what the content is. But if all the propeller heads in the world are migrating to this blog through word of mouth, he's obviously figured something cool out, right? If you didn't have these channels of self-expression and this availability to find, you don't see this. Let me flip it over to a knowledge management thing for a second. In knowledge management, what we used to do is think about stops, not flows. So we got into these big, massive, monolithic databases that we tried to tag. And we did a study right here in Boston, actually. Rob Cross, you may know, now is down at UVA, did a study. We said all these consultants who go into these databases to find documents and articles that they can potentially reuse with other clients, how do they use it? 5 times out of 6, when they go in and find a relevant document, you know what they do? They call the person who wrote it. So we had a lot of infrastructure around taxonomy, around scrubbing, around cleaning. basically to try and find another person. I think self-expression through blogging and then having tools like social tagging to allow you to shrink that world that is increasing through the entire read-write web gets people to connect faster. To me, information is the currency. People are the transport mechanism. Conversation is the transfer mechanism. And insight is the value creator. And that's what we go to.
Okay, so let me shift the conversation here a little bit, because I'm an e-learning developer, and I'm sitting out in the audience. Actually, Brent, if you were sitting in the audience right now, okay, you're in Hoxton Valley, you're just getting going in e-learning, that all sounds great, guys, but that, you guys, that doesn't sound like me, right? So translate what you guys are talking about here to, well, what does this mean? When is this stuff meaningful? Should I actually be doing this? I mean, I'm not getting it. Where does it actually work? Do you want to take a swing at it, Brent?
Well, when you brought that 1% e-learning guild data in, when you brought the 1% e-learning data guild in, and I'm sorry, I don't know, I have to talk to Steve about the question, but the question is how much are us learners using this technology versus how much is that technology being used in the company? Because I think those are two very different things. Do we as learning, because I sit in corporate learning and I'm interested, okay, we're going to now use Wiki and blogs for instructional purposes, which we did do with industry, versus how much is it going on all by itself.
And this is a number expressed by the e-learning guild membership.
It's probably what we as what learners we use. We're going to apply.
No. It's what we use today.
Oh, that's different than what... So if I just say, if you ask me at IBM how much are you using Wiki, I'll say we're using it for industry content because the people at the edge know more and it's easier for them to put that content in. But that's only 1% of e-learning courses that we deliver everything else. If you ask me how much are Wiki being used at IBM, that's a much bigger number.
Okay.
See my question?
So if I'm sitting, I completely understand what you're saying. I guess the question I have, though, is if I'm sitting in the audience, is all of this just theoretical mumbo-jumbo, or does it actually have impact? And if it has impact, where is it going to have impact on me?
So I think one of the biggest terms that also connects with this is control, right? And as a practitioner, as an instructional designer, or something within the corporate world, and I think even within the school, I think Stephen would agree that there is this concept in the walls that you discussed, and a perfect example of this, the cultures that we have to deal with, that you're going to have to go back and deal with and say, I learned all of this great stuff about wikis and blogs and social networking and connecting people. The fight you're going to have is getting people to let go of the control and the centralized way that we used to do things, the 1.0 version of how we did what we did. So once you understand that you have to let go of that control, that's your biggest fight. People, we've found, the Intel example, I mean, examples all over the place, people want to share. People want to connect with other people, and they want to have discussions, and so they want to make this stuff happen. So you don't have any problem with getting your users to connect with this stuff and to get into it. The problem you have is in the control structure and getting the management and those folks to understand that the loosely joined pieces of your organization is where all of your brilliance lies and where all of the knowledge needs to happen. So to personalize it, Hospice of the Valley has 15 different what they call PCUs, palliative care units, where they care for the dying. And they also have a whole fleet, 90% of what they do is in the home, and they care for people at home. So we've got kind of like Salesforce training, right? People scattered everywhere that are out there. But all of these folks are dealing with the same issues on a day-to-day basis, dealing with the exact same things. It's just a different patient with a different name with a different diagnosis. These people rarely talk with each other and rarely get connected. So the biggest excitement for me is having an opportunity in this space to tell these folks, here are some tools that are open source and free that we can dial up, that we can start getting these different 15 different units across the board that run 24/7, giving them the ability to talk to each other. Somebody that's on a 2 a.m. shift without much to do can maybe blog or connect virtually through some of these tools with one of the other care units and say, I've got a patient going through this right now, and having those discussions. And the technology becoming more of an enabler. The technology isn't about technology the way it was in e-learning 1.0. The technology is about people. And all of this stuff is about the people, finally, right? It's what the web was originally intended to try and support. It's what it's finally doing. It's about the people. It's about connecting people. It's not so much about the technology. The technology just enables it and makes those connections for you.
I'm curious, has anybody in the audience implemented blogging or wikis or any other content generation? What do you use this one?
We actually have a blog for my very small portion of it. We're technology trainers and we put out a tip of the week on our blog.
Okay.
And we used to do it by email, but since switching over to the blog format, we've gotten so many positive responses from people. They add comments to it, which are there, and then they can research. We have, you know, categories. So when they look at a comment on Word, I mean, it's just a simple thing, but
it's almost like an ongoing newsletter, but with the ability for user feedback to comment.
Yeah, and the fact that they can go back and look up. I remember that tip was sent 6 months ago, but I need it now. And then they can go and look for it. And
I mean, now it's searchable too, right? So when you can put something out there in the blogosphere or within a wiki, it automatically becomes part of everything that's searchable. The email stuff never really falls into that category, and especially, you know, in the Outlook space and things like that, it's much more difficult to search for that information and to find where it is.
Well, again, people tell me, oh, we just asked those tips to put them in binders, and we were like, oh, yeah. So they're very pleased that they didn't have to do that anymore.
Well, they still
print them out. Well, probably, because people do, yeah.
Anybody else?
Well, I'm in an organization where I needed to put some technical information out, sort of how-tos, maybe frequently asked type questions, and I mentioned this yesterday. So we put out these tech tips on a wiki, and then directed people, like, okay, you might be able to find some insight into what you do by coming to the site. One of the subject matter experts hit the site, looked at it, got so excited, immediately sent an email saying that he wanted to be the editor. You know, he wanted to take ownership and started pushing it to other subject matter experts. Took ownership of it. Now he's editing the stuff. Now people are adding stuff, and it's just taken on a life of its own. And my hands are off of it now. It's like mission accomplished. Move on. Take a look at the next thing. And it's living its own life.
One of the things I've been seeing a lot of is replacement. So anybody who's editing web pages today, looking at possibly replacing that with wiki technologies and basically the same processes you're using today, but then opening up the possibility of learners or subject matter experts being able to edit it. It's so easy to use. It's a lot easier than using Dreamweaver. And so it's a sort of a nice incremental strategy to get there. Let's talk a little bit about the quality question, because that always comes up. And whenever anybody hears about this stuff, I mean, you know, how do we know your subject matter experts are putting decent stuff out there? How do we know the end learners are putting decent stuff out there? How do we ensure appropriate quality of the content? Don't we produce better stuff than those end users? Any thoughts on that, guy? Is that a real issue?
Yeah, I always just ask the question, Mac, whenever it's at the corporate level, when people ask me, you know, we can't open up these open source things because there's no, how do we know that it's good? And I say, well, how did you know that the guy writing it, the book, was good? You know, I mean, same question you could have asked with any other type of media that somebody had created. How do we know? How do we know that the Encyclopedia Britannica was written by smart people? Who, you know, how do we know? Well, the brand, we tend to trust the brand Encyclopedia Britannica, but we just kind of left it as, oh, this must be right, when a lot of it wasn't, you know, that they come to find out. So I always like to flip the question around. I mean, what's the same process? How do we know? And that's just, it's a whole other question, I think, and another discussion on trust and how do you build that network and how do you know who's trustworthy and how do you make that distinction?
I think you want to approach this whole subject, especially those of you, which is probably all of you, who are working in corporations. You need to approach this but not as stuff that you're setting up for other people, but rather how you yourself are going to learn. And a lot of these questions get answered in that way. The previous question, you know, what do you do? How do you go about it? What do you do to start? So we'll just wait for that to cycle. What is that?
Sorry.
Space is lightning.
There's no real malady, though. Sort of expected, I don't know, someone starts thinking. People say, well, how do you get set up? And I say, well, start a blog. And if you start one internally, start one externally, start one externally, start one externally, doesn't matter. And I know there are rules and constraints and controls and as much as you can possibly do without being fired and sometimes even pushing that envelope a bit, ignore those. Because this technology, by its nature, works best when those boundaries and those controls are ignored. And you have to take the attitude, this is your career, right? This is your learning, your future. Just think about this. If you leave your career in the hands of your manager, how secure is that career? Ask yourself that. So it's your learning, and part of your learning is to gather resources and put them on your blog and then share your blog because that's how you get comments and criticisms from other people. And that's how it starts. You don't go to the boss and ask for approval and funding and make it a big project and things like that because it won't work. Right. If it's you serving your own learning need, it will work. And then somebody will come to you, how do you know that? Well, this is what I do, right? And then they individually serve their own learning needs. And same with questions of quality, right? If you depend on somebody out there to choose what's good or bad for you, you are running a terrible risk. It's like you're designing your mind as though it was Microsoft software, right? The bugs and the viruses will get in. You have to have a mental firewall, which Microsoft doesn't have. Right? You have to determine for yourself what's good or what's bad. You make that call individually and autonomously. And the thing is, when you're doing that, and the next person's doing that, and the next person's doing that, and you're applying simple rules of reason, does this accord with what I've seen myself in my ordinary life? Does this follow common principles of logic? Is it not an attack on the person? Is it not a false dilemma? Things like that. If you follow very simple rules, you find that the information that you get and the other people who are engaged in similar practices on the aggregate is not only as good as things like Britannica, it's much better. It's much more reliable.
I bet Britannica doesn't have an entry on the email.
I love what you're saying in terms of start with what I want to learn. And I think that the question on the board, where do you start, is kind of where I'm coming from. I'm at the very beginning level, and I'm familiar with how to use Wiki. If I see elements on the web that I like, the blog, the video speech, the little vignettes, there's a lot of pieces that I would like to be able to create in my own learning environment that I would then share with students. I'm in academia. Where do I start figuring out the right tools when there's so many different ones, but how to get them to talk to each other?
Setting a blog with bloggers.
Yeah.
And create a community with
the... Don't even bother with anything else. Create a blog with bloggers. And just put the stuff that interests you in your blog, and eventually you may need to do something that blogger doesn't do, ask how. And eventually the other things, whether it's a wiki or Writely and whatever, all these things, that eventually they will become part of your environment, either through your meeting or through your writing with yourself.
The tools are all very simple to use. It takes almost no time to get up and going on them. It really
I've done an Amazon session where we got up to speed on Blogger and social book marketing.
There's a fear factor with technology. Now, I'll tell you, this is exactly how I got started. I was exactly where you were at 2.5 years ago, was when I first opened up my Blogger account. I was really excited about Stephen's blog, and my friend Mark Taylor was blogging, and Jay Cross, and everybody had this great stuff out there, and I wanted to be a part of that too. I loved what they were saying, I loved consuming it, and I didn't know where to start, and I wanted to create something fabulous, you know, because it had to be great, and I wanted a logo, and I wanted it to be really cool, like theirs was. And then at the end of the day, what I finally realized was, that it's not about all of that stuff. It's just about starting. Just get in there. It takes you 5 minutes to start it. Come up with something and then start adding stuff to it. Over time, when you find time, you'll figure out how to, you know, add other stuff to it and improve it. But all of this 2.0 stuff is about starting with plain Jane, nothing, and just going for it. You just have to start. That's the biggest hurdle, is just getting started. So I encourage you to just do it.
In an academic setting, one thing I would highly encourage is putting the class notes, syllabus, all that stuff on wikis. And then you'll suddenly realize, oh, yeah, I've got an opportunity where the students could contribute onto this portion of it. That was a fantastic revelation for me about a year ago when I had done exactly that.
If you're wondering how to do that, I think it's still
Google Docs,
but
it got
shut down. Oh, real.
Well, we have to install that, right?
No. Open Service.
Oh, okay.
Great guy. Oh, is it hosted?
Yeah.
Okay. Go to PBWiki, create a wiki there. Like, don't start thinking of installing software and writing stuff and all that.
Do
free hosted stuff.
I think this is really important. The one thing, if I'm in the audience, I try to put myself in the audience's place for a second. I think the fundamental question here that where we got resistance on this stuff is, what is that learning? You know, okay, we're responsible. And okay, cool, how am I going to tell my man, how am I going to manage this stuff? You know, so there's been 20,000 hits to some person's blog somewhere. Can you argue that people learn from hitting that?
Sure.
Is that level 4 on chiropractic scale, and how does that translate into ROI? Okay, well, you can't get money. How many can you? No, I'm with you, but I'm speaking from the corporate side.
Yeah, well, corporate, ignore the corporate side. Even if you're in a corporation, ignore the corporate side.
So I think Stephen's advice and echoes here is start using it for you, because your motivation is intrinsic.
Right.
And out of that use, your desire to get smart about, okay, now I need to do something different than a blog is what I'm trying to do with this, like aggregate herbs around a certain topic, we'll do that. Wiki, and start using it for you to build your own knowledge. And then as educators, which we all are, whether we're inside or outside the firewall, literally, you'll start to see the application. So some of the things we've done is Guerrilla Web 2.0. So within a course, there's always been a course where you have, you know, reflection. Is reflection a part of learning? I mean, somebody wrote something about that. Right. Okay, so instead of it being a personal journal, does anyone know Doogie Howser, that old show where the dude at the end is a doctor who's like really smart, and he like puts his deep thoughts into the computer and shuts it off? All a blog is now, instead of shutting it off, the whole world can see it. Now, yeah, that's essentially what a blog is. So now, instead of doing personal journals, we use and if you're not a personal journal, you're opening a kimono to everybody else in your classroom. So beware that what we're wanting you to do is reflect, but reflect publicly. Oh my God, Germany, you can't do that. You know, so there's all these rules, but we get around. So that's an application of a blog within an instructional context that's vetted, theoretically. But now we're just using that piece. Then there's wikis. Okay, we need to get industries grow fast, and industries change fast. So the instructional model of grab willing subject matter experts, suck them into the halls of corporate dungeons, extract stuff from their brain, put it through a manufacturing process, spit it back out to where it's already out of date because the industry's changed 2 times since we've gone through that process, doesn't work. Work it at the edge. Ergo wikis. make it really lightweight, ask people to contribute, and if someone says that's wrong and that's going to screw up the company, they will contribute. So we went from a centralized model of industry blocking and trying to make it instructional to what the heck's going on in the industry and how can we make money.
Okay, a couple more questions. We're already about 10 minutes behind, so I kind of expect this to happen. We'll have to go You've only got one topic so far.
Look at who you asked. We're talking to the panel.
I understand blogging rules and guidelines. Now, let's just say you're proposing Intel, a blog that's external out of a firewall, and you're running into their legal, and we don't want you to do that, or, you know, how do we have to be able to control that content. How do you fight that? Our personal thought is if we can't do the blog right, we don't do it. But we know that the answer is worse.
Right, so we ran into that. The problem is that you just, most people are smart enough to know what they can and can't talk about or what they should and shouldn't talk about. When the beautiful thing from a corporate standpoint, so I'll look at both sides of it. As a person internal to a company like Intel, I don't care. If I want to do something outside of work, I do it anyway because it's outside of work. And so create a blog outside of work. The problem comes in when you take something that's proprietary, that's internal, and you take it outside of work and you do something else with it. It's no different. So just because you blogged about it, it's no different than me hitting the print button, taking a red covered document that's right, all red documents are supposed to stay internal. Nobody checks my bag when I walk out of Intel. I can print out whatever I want and I can walk out and I can hand it out on the street corner. And to people. Nobody ever checks that. Nobody ever finds out. Nobody ever knows. If I post something on the blog, everybody knows. So from a corporate standpoint, if I'm out there posting secrets or something like that, you can see it. Now you can manage what is out there because there are ways you can search the whole entire blogosphere and the internet for that matter using Google different search criteria and see what's going on out there. You could just set up a Google search for Intel. Anytime anybody says Intel in their blog, you get a ping on that, right? So now you can monitor the world and see what the world is saying about Intel. If all of a sudden you see there's a rogue blogger out there that just posted the spec for the next Pentium whatever chip, now you know about it. What you don't know is all of the people that printed that out and handed it to AMD and all the other competition, and it never happened. So you can look at this as a bad thing and be scared to death, or you can look at the openness as a wonderful way for you to see what's going on and to give you a sort of dashboard into all of the conversations that are going on out there. Now you don't have to manage it, so to speak. You participate and you get that information and you become part of that cycle. So don't be afraid. Don't run it through legal. You just go out and you just do it.
I've run it through MarCom, find out if there's any existing policies and procedures for your organization. And then just if you were in Intel, you could say, I work for a large chip manufacturer. Just don't say anything to the blog. You wouldn't feel comfortable saying, publicly. And I think,
you
ought to use that policy anyhow.
And again, at IBM, I venture to guess we have more corporate attorneys than most companies.
But you also have a rather forward-looking blogging policy.
Fair. Absolutely fair. But what I'm saying is these guidelines, right, are there, and I post them on my blog. It's almost like this is what I'm supposed to do. And part of how I assess myself is when I read what other people say about my blog, I don't like it if they say, he seems like he's pushing IBM too much, because that's not what my intent is. So I think some of this legal stuff is trodden. There's thin firms to address it.
Okay. Well, I would say, too, that there's probably somebody in both Intel and IBM's legal shop that has Google search in their job.
They probably have a large chip manufacturer as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, I know something about Microsoft in my blog. I noticed on my traffic, all of a sudden, there's a Microsoft bot showing up pretty much daily for almost 2 weeks. After Microsoft is published.
Okay, I'm going to take this opportunity to move on to the next topic. talking about personalized learning, which is actually in some ways not too far away from what we were sort of just talking about. And actually, Stephen, you're doing a session on personal learning environments right after this. And I happen to be doing
that immediately after. I have to finish writing it.
Oh, okay. I think you've got lunch in between. And interestingly, I'm doing a session on LMSs at the same time. And yeah, exactly. It depends on whether you're on the light side or the dark side. But why don't you tell us a little bit about personalized learning and personal learning environments and how that sort of plays in? You know, what's the thought behind PLE?
Okay, first of all, let me be clear. Personal learning environments don't exist yet. There are a few prototypes, they don't even really work that well yet. But the idea of personal learning environments is that you have your own personal learning space. This space connects up with a wide range of external resources, blogger, wiki, delicious bookmarking services, YouTube, the video, things we're not talking about, virtual worlds, right? And so from this personal space, you access all of these different resources, you bring from them what you want into your space, to use your space to modify, to mash up, to create, to repurpose, to remix, to share, to do whatever it is that you feel that you want to do with this material, and then from your personal learning environment, you then send it forth into the world, either as a blog post or a photo on Flickr or a video on YouTube or whatever. So basically, it's the thing that keeps track of all of your different web things that you're doing. Remember we said to start with Blogger. When you start with Blogger, but eventually you've got Blogger, you've got Delicious, you've got Flickr, there's the problem of all your email addresses and the legal ones and the illegal ones and all. It's just the way to keep track of this. But the thing is, the personal learning environment becomes, I don't want to say subversive because I know what crowd I'm in, but it does separate your learning from the official program, right? Your learning becomes yours. And now for all of you, from the perspective of people who are creating training, you're about to enter into a world where people manage their own learning rather than having you manage it for them. And that is going to cause an awful lot of chaos and confusion in your discipline.
And it's interesting, too, because while Stephen says personal learning environments don't really exist today, that's capital personal learning environments. Every one of us has our own personal learning environment, whether we're conscious of it or not. Yeah. All the tools and systems you use, so if you adopt a blogging as a practice, that will become part of your personal learning environment, and it will become an incredibly important part of your personal learning environment. So adopting things from a personal learning perspective, if you believe that that's an important thing to do, then this is really important. Now, from a sort of different end of the spectrum, Tony, you've been doing some really interesting things to help guide people toward learning that's most important and relevant to them through sort of assessment. And so could you tell us a little bit about some of the things you're doing to help guide?
Yeah, I'm kind of in two minds here because I'm coming out of a two-day meeting, corporate learning strategy type meeting, and I'll couch it based on what Stephen said. I think we're really at a very important strategic point as learning professionals inside the firewall, maybe outside too, but certainly inside, where the dominant paradigm for a long time has been find out what you suck at and fill the gap. So there's kind of this individual is a composite of skills, competencies, whatever you want to call it, and our job is to kind of decompose that down and then tell you what to take and re-emphasize gaps, and strengths, and all that kind of stuff.
The problem is that that's kind of a static, skill-oriented view of things. And one of the things that's really cool about, so there's things we can do there. One of the things we're doing there at IBM is the way that information is exploding, we will all have a skill gap all the time. There is no doubt about that. And that's widening as things go on. So this notion of closing the gap is a bit of a red herring in my mind, just because the skill gaps I have today, precipitated by the variety of things which I work, will be changing on an ongoing basis. So we'll never be fooled. So that, you know, it's like how technology and life kind of comes together. Some go, the network is the computer. It's like, to me, the network is the classroom. And to me, our goal is not how quickly we pour stuff into people's heads, it's how quickly we get people to tune the network to the problem we have at hand, right? And then the question becomes, okay, well, if that's the case, how do I measure how much I filled your gap? Which tends to be how we get paid, how we develop, design content, and how we kind of justify our existence within the corporate system. The problem I see is that's kind of going away. And what we're looking for is generative learning and insights rather than teaching people how to do things they already know how to do. Because they start to figure that out pretty quickly with Web 2.0 anyway. So instead of kind of intermediating this whole process with skills and subject matter experts and content and LMSs, people figure that stuff out quicker now through the blog, through the virtual networking technology. My question is more than how do we take that to the next level and apply that, apply the social networking technology in a way that allows for generative learning. And I'd like to point Stephen out here because I think he's really pushing the envelope. Those of us in the blog space, what we're doing is double with learning. There's kind of extant learning, which is, you know, what's the capital of Kuala Lumpur, or what's the capital of Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, stuff like that. But then when you get into it, you want to know more subtleties. If you track the blogosphere, you can get to the subtlety you want, and you can get to the richest you want faster. And back to Stephen's point, what he's really good about, and I want to commend the public for this, he's not resistant to pushback. If somebody puts something up on the blog, they'll say, I don't buy that for these reasons. And then that makes you go learn about these reasons. And then somebody else pushes something else back. So instead of just living in the content scale, and instead of just living in the skill scale, you're now in the insight, and you're getting to see what's going on in Stephen's head, then you're getting to see what's going on in Brent's head, then you're getting to see what's going on in Tony's head, and you're formulating your own opinion. Then what you get to do through these personalized learning environments is you're exposing your learning back out to the community so they can double with you on what you're doing. For me, that's really powerful. The problem is our existing learning model don't allow us to justify investment in that kind of thing because it's bad luck energy. So I don't know if that would be answering the question, but I felt like I had to.
Let me actually draw this around to the other end, which is sort of the input that we feel we need to give to learners to direct them towards. Because I think a lot of what faces learners is they don't necessarily know what learning they need and what the opportunities are and sort of the guidance from that side of it. So you can try to do everything bottom up, but the directing them towards it. I know you guys have done a lot with trying to assess and give people guidance toward digital learning opportunities. Certainly in several of the projects I worked on, like one was even customer satisfaction, you've got all this great survey data that you can hand off to the store managers. You know, you can guide them towards solutions that are going to make the most sense and have them formulate action plans and learning off of that. So there's a lot of assessment stuff that's very possible and rather easy to get into these days, both the tools to do assessment as well as the data that sits out there for us. And then you can sort of guide people into content that's the most meaningful for them to go after in whatever form, be it classic e-learning kind of solutions or drawing e-learning 2.0 type solutions. But a lot of what you're seeing happening is there's sort of things coming at it from both sides here. People need to take responsibility for their own learning and among knowledge, like that's certainly the case. But there's also a need for guidance here. It's what is going to be meaningful and relevant to me. In fact, that's probably in some ways my harder problem all the time is, gee, I know I can be a lot better as the CEO of my company, right? But I just don't know where I suck the most. To paraphrase Tony.
I'd be happy to tell you.
On that note,
I just want to make this point because I think it's an important point. There seems to be this human instinct that when somebody out there is doing something that maybe they shouldn't do or maybe not as well as we would like them to do or something like that, our instinct is to do one of two things. Either tell them something, give them a bunch of facts, or worse, tell them what to do, right? So it becomes some sort of process where we're going to tell them something, right? And there's whole theories of learning that are based on that idea, this whole transactional distance and all of that, right, is based on, okay, I'm going to tell people things. And it doesn't work. And the reason why, well, there's all kinds of reasons why it doesn't work, but mostly it's because people aren't listening. Even now, as I'm sitting here telling you this, I know I'm hitting maybe some small percentage, but what's happening is the other messages are overwhelming. Other people have said this much more eloquently than I have, but to teach isn't to tell. To teach is to model and to demonstrate, to be whatever it is that you're attempting to communicate. And even as I sit here now, right, you're not listening to the words so much as you're watching the behavior and even things like the way I'm dressed and the way I gesture. Did I do what he told me to or not? What kind of relation do we have going on in this panel? Are we all equal and egalitarian, or is it all that kind of stuff constitutes the lesson. And the words are almost meaningless. So if you're going like that, see?
Yeah, I disagree with you on that. But I think the fundamental point actually echoes exactly what we heard this morning from the keynote, which is basically change is going to come based on us understanding the delta between the status quo and the external input. And you have to bring people through the chaos in between. And
you can't bring them through. They have to bring themselves through. All you can do is show the way. And the only way to show the way is to go there yourself first.
Okay. And provide support for them as they go through the chaos.
We will always have those employees that don't give any 2 cents about what it is that they're doing, why are they want a paycheck, they don't want to learn, they don't want to take responsibility for their learning, so how do we deal with that? And then you will always have those employees who are feel incredibly empowered and do great stuff. So I think a lot of the frustration, a lot of the difficulty that you're going to have is you cannot take this new paradigm that we're talking about that has had so much power around it and demand that everybody in the organization do it. These
right.
folks that we have within our organization that don't care. They're just there to push a widget, push a button, do whatever. They're just there to collect a paycheck to get new rims for their ride. They're there for that reason. They don't support it. I think over a longer period of time, people are going to start to understand that they own it. But it's a cultural thing right now. We've been told throughout the ages that our teachers tell us what we're supposed to learn. Our managers tell us what we're supposed to do and guide it. There's been this hierarchical structure, and it's all tipping on its side now, and you have to maintain control of your own learning environment, your own career, your own job. And that's a culture shift that's going to take a long time before it's permeated throughout everyone.
Big percentage, though, that really don't care at the end of the day. I know you see the Gallup engagement numbers. A lot of people are disengaged. Okay?
Yeah, it's a question of ownership. How much do you work for IBM? How much of IBM do you own? How much of that is yours?
Right? So what else are you doing besides your job? I mean, the reason I don't leave all the kids is because people have great reasons to not want to be always focused on their work. And yet, it's the degree that they don't own their job bigger than at work, then they're not in control of their future. I mean, it's a
Balance. If your learning is not supporting what it is that you want to do to make your life better, however you perceive that to be, then you have no purpose to doing this learning, and why would you? And I ask, why should you?
Yeah, let me just track off right. So that's an important point. If you look at the MySpace generation today and the people coming in behind us, essentially, if the network becomes the classroom, not the network doesn't be a network, it's a classroom, did anyone realize that teach and cheat are anagrams? So when we moved into the MySpace generation, they basically distributed the work according to the people who do it best. But who knows the physics ground? Okay, so we'll all be on MySpace at a certain time. You do the physics homework, I'll do the English homework. We'll discuss how we kind of altered enough so the plagiarizing thing that the teacher has doesn't catch it. And that way we get to do what we do, but we still all get good grades.
Cool.
Yeah. Right, so I got a talk in D.C. actually, in Vancouver, to a bunch of people who were teaching these folks. And I'm kind of like, be screwed. Because, that's how they work. And actually, this goes to playing to your strengths and social networking and figuring out who knows what to do and getting the task accomplished, which a corporate walk like me says, well, that's pretty cool. So they're self-organizing around the activity and they're doing what they like best. How can we get some more of that going inside the corporation? Because our morale right now sucks and people are leaving. And actually, I just come off a study where we actually asked that question. Isn't that weird? A company like IBM trying to figure out what is it about the dynamics of that kind of environment that allows people to be fulfilled, that allows tasks to get accomplished, and everyone feels like they're learning. What's wrong with it? But I go back to budget, skill gap closure, and all those things that are the legacies and vestiges of how we do our work. And should an LMS track informal learning? Should we doubt informal learning as people who moniker it as informal learning because it's not formal? Well, there's nothing informal about a seller trying to go to Boise, Idaho tomorrow who doesn't know jack about the peanut industry and has to sound smart tomorrow and is highly motivated to understand about it. And our competitors Google. They're going to Google peanut industry, they're going to get what they can get, they're going to read it on the plane, and they're going to try and not speak it tomorrow. The motivation and the teachable moment that fits within the work context, and we collectively as a group label it informal and absolve ourselves of responsibility for helping that person learn, shame on us.
Let me move things forward. There's a few more topics, and I want to hit the one about open source, open content really quickly, and what I want to do is get sort of a closed-in question. Brett, I know you are looking, you're kind of ground floor up right now at Hospice Valley. I know you're looking at open source solutions like the Open Academic Suite. What do you think of those, the possibility for you adopting those? What kind of some of the trade-offs you're going through? Are you going to adopt them?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of taking the easy stuff and quickly getting it out there and just seeing what happens with it, right? And just doing it. I've seen successes with it that way, and I've also seen the incredible failures of million-dollar, 18-month enterprise rollout things that nobody uses them, everybody hates them, and it's a complete nightmare. The thing I really, really love about an open-source suite or an open-source tool like MediaWiki or Moodle as an open-source tool. Granted, all of these tools have their frustrations and some difficulties, but at their very basic core, they have some very, very, very good things that we can do, and they can support us in some of the things that we already do. So for me to turn one on and to start using it takes zero time at all. $5 a month, and I'll even give a plug for SiteGround.com is a hosting provider that is absolutely phenomenal. The best customer support I've ever had with a web provider, and believe me, I've gone through plenty of them. They have a great customer support, and all I did was shoot an email to their desk service. They installed MediaWiki for me, they installed Moodle, they installed Drupal, and they installed ELGG, just for me to go in and just play with them and have at it. I've now got them kind of up and running. The company is called SiteGround, SiteGround.com. And I'm sure there's other ones out there. I just ran into them, and there's a great tool called Fantastico that has all these open source tools, where just at the click of a button, it installs on the server for you. But Elg is not part of Fantastico, and MediaWiki is not part of Fantastico. So I just shot them an email and said, hey, can you guys load these up? And I said, yeah, sure, no problem. 10 minutes.
Okay.
They had it fired up Elg.
It's an installable social networking tool.
If you go to Brent's blog, you're not going to get the names of them, you'll get his take on it, you'll get Stephen's take on what they eat, and someone else can say something's a little bit better than SiteGround, you should think about this one, and then you're off. You're on your person and running that.
Yeah.
One thing really interesting on the Moodle topic is we just did the LMS report here among the eLearning Guild members. Even among very large corporations, 2,000 plus employees, 2,000 plus learners, Moodle was 20% market share. I mean, it has an amazing traction. Now, I did interviews of a lot of folks who are in large corporations. Almost all of them used it as an intermediary. And we know we're going to go to some bigger solution later, but let's not kill ourselves now trying to adopt too much. Let's go do something quick. Get it up and going. It's got high satisfaction numbers, but it just doesn't do that much today. You're not going to use it to drive your entire compliance program, but it's a great place to get started, and the cost is right.
There's tools for AICC and scoring compatibility, and you can just plug stuff in. So if you get a module or you borrow a module, so in the open source development community that we're trying to foster right now, every single corporation teaches a lot of the same stuff, and we as instructional designers in all of these corporations, we're all reinventing the wheel all the time with certain topics, you know, certain generic topics.
Because
nobody shares this stuff.
And on that note, any open courseware things that folks in the room maybe should know about what's going on out there? Where can I go get content that might be helpful for my organization?
Open courseware, maybe?
Yeah, there isn't an opencourseware.org or something that's out there.
Tell us a little bit about that, too.
Well, I mean, I want to say something else too, so I'll come out to that. And it's an important thing too.
Okay.
It's one of these things you have to take home with you. There is a whole movement out there for the production of what has come to be called either open courseware, although that presupposes a very specific and wrong picture of learning, or more generically, open educational resources. This is big. This is not small. This is huge. The open educational resources, for example, has been the subject of a sustained development program by UNICEF for a number of years. And in fact, they've just recently come out with an open educational resources platform. I'll probably run a link to that newsletter this afternoon because I keep meaning to it, I keep forgetting. I don't really forget to it. There's open courseware, which of course from across the river, everybody knows about MIT's open courseware. They've developed also something called the Open Courseware Consortium, which is now about 10 or 12 major universities all creating and distributing open courseware. And the licenses to these things allow you not just to use it, to use it, to take it apart, to do what you want with it.
OpenContent.org.
OpenContent.org is another one.
I'm
not sure which one that is, though, so off the top of my head. I know that David Wiley at Utah has been involved with a whole series of these projects over the years. There are less formal projects. There's a project that put the entire curriculum from South Africa onto a wiki, where we are going to teach again. Well, people do that when you put it on a wiki. And of course, Wikipedia is a very large open content. The Wikipedia license allows you to do whatever you want with it. Me, I access Wikipedia, such in the content process and display it on my website just for fun, because I can. And those are just a few. And you're talking about you know, open source software. There's Moodle. There's an enterprise system called Sakai, S-A-K-A-I, which is being developed by the major universities. It's enterprise Java type stuff. It combines with the Open Knowledge Initiative, OKI, and a bunch of other things. There's major suite of open source tools coming on. There's Boddington, which is an open source LMS out of Britain. There's A-Tutor, I don't know where that's out of. Moodle, of course, is from Australia. Elg is from Britain. It's like an open source LMS, except it's based on social networking principles. Moodle is based on social constructivist learning pedagogy, sort of, I think of. But now the take-home. If you are in the business of developing educational software to sell, or if you are in the business of developing educational content to sell, get out of those businesses. Because already open source has practically, you know, is decimating you know, the learning software industry, and really badly. And Blackboard, which is the major player of commercial software in the academic space, shot itself in the foot by launching lawsuits over this stuff. People, especially in the academic community, are just trampling over themselves to get out of buying commercial software. They don't want to do it anymore. They've been burned too many times. And the same story with content. People are realizing it makes no sense to develop content. You talk about, you know, obviously, you know, the open source development communities and encouraging open source development. And, you know, all these companies are realizing, you know, Perl works the same on your installation as mine. And so the same, you know, the same little bit of instruction, the same sample codes. A lot of this is just samples and things like that. It's not so much formal instructions. Just samples, bits of code, pictures, diagrams, more bits of code, whatever. You know, even the nature of this instructional context is changing. It's shattering. It's breaking apart. You don't even recognize it. You don't see the competition because you don't recognize it. You're expecting open courses, you know, maybe like the ones that Open University in Britain, they're releasing all of their courses, complete free online as well. I forgot to mention that. In fact, what you think this all looks like, but it isn't. All these little snippets, videos on YouTube, major competition for you.
I agree, and also I think I was somewhat involved in the MIT thing, and Michael Rapid, who's now at Carolina State, the big aha for people on this, the business people, the people who think about money, is you just change the pay point.
Right.
So it used to be pay for access. So we've got all this cool MIT content, and you have to pay for an MIT education to get access to the content. Well, why not open that up, which doesn't pay for proof or the credential that comes from saying I brought the content.
Yeah.
So now you set the content free.
Right.
Yeah, I know, because that's what got them there.
Yeah, but I mean, now we're moving into a world of, you know, independent certification,
portfolios,
you are what you built, you know, all of that sort of thing. So, you know, what role was it? Was it Carson? No, was that games thing there? The games panel yesterday where they're saying, you know, people who are really good at World of Warcraft, those are the ones who make good managers. And so now, if you know that that's true, why are you requiring an MBA? Right? I want to see your World of Warcraft one.
I don't know. I've got the World of Warcraft guy in my shop, and then I have the silly one with the injury. But
are they good managers, or are they good at doing what they're told?
All of those open courseware initiatives, we'll do our best to catalog those and get them out on our blog over the next few days. And actually, one thing to mention, all four of us blog. In fact, I got to know each of them through blogging. We have this discussion all the time through our blogs. So if you're actually enjoying this discussion, I wish you could participate more, ask questions, all of that. I would highly encourage you to visit our respective blogs as well.
One question. So should should a training department then consider hiring somebody who's good at, say, a like Pearl or PHP, bringing schools together, bringing, like, if you're interested in doing something like a Joomla with a Moodle and maybe have some other kind of a web conferencing tool that you have to bring into one of those LMSs. You know, need to integrate it, like if you're on the corporate side, you're probably going to integrate with your CRM system, like maybe a Salesforce.com. These are all built on APIs, like, so keeping a web 2.0 web services. This is a good idea then in that case to consider buying, sorry, to hire somebody who's pretty technical and pretty savvy and putting these tools together.
You know, I would say in the short term, if you have the money, yes. You know, but I don't want to say that to scare everybody else away. There's a lot of stuff that you can do, you know, without having all of that knowledge and without doing it, you know. But if you have a lot of other requirements, like you're talking about, you want to connect Moodle up with your larger LMS within your organization, if you want to do some sort of modifications and customizations, then yes, of course, you need somebody that can drill into that code a little bit to do it. But I would recommend that you're looking for somebody, find somebody that has more breadth and not as much depth. You don't want somebody who's a diehard, just totally focused on Perl, and that's what they've done their whole life. They may be the best Perl coder you've ever seen in your entire life, and they're fabulous, but Perl may not be used in the next tool that comes along.
We'll break PHP.
Yeah, and then you got PHP and all that kind of stuff. So I like the idea of firing something up really fast and using it, because I know in very short order it's going to be gone and there's going to be something better right around the corner. So I want to get it up, I want to get it running, but I also want to know that all of that stuff can very easily be moved into the next thing that comes around the corner. I don't want to waste a lot of time customizing something because it's going to be old. Are wikis going to be called wikis in the next couple of years, or is everything just going to act wiki-ish?
Well, they'll be called Google Spaces.
Are blogs going to continue to be blogs, or are we going to call it just the conversations that you have online? You know, and it's just how we live our life and how we do our digital space. So the terms and the technologies will change very, very rapidly, as you can all see.
There's a lot you can do without scripting any of this stuff. You can get a lot just with installation. The moment you get some integration, the AV needs some help with that. You could theoretically outsource it, but having somebody there, if you're going to have ongoing requirements like that.
I would say, too, that the community, especially around Moodle, the Moodle community is awesome. I just kind of watched the forum just out of sheer interest in watching people and other people learn. And there's teachers who aren't technically involved at all. These are K-12 people who are just excited about cranking up Moodle in their classes. And they're asking very technical questions. I wanted to be able to do this and do that. And somebody will come in and say, oh, well, you have to plug in this script. And they sit back and they're like, I don't have any idea what you're talking about. And somebody will walk them through it. And they'll say, open up this file. Do you know how to find that file? And they will. And they'll come back and they'll say, yeah, I did it. And they're so excited. And, you know, and they do all this really great stuff because it's this community, this social space of other people who are doing the same thing.
I want to make the point, right, because the question was, should we have somebody on staff who does this stuff? And the real answer is, you should be able to pick enough of it up in an afternoon in order to do it yourself. And that's a hard skill. But that's, you know, if you want to improve learning in your organization, acquire that skill. Figure out how to find the knowledge, generally these days on Google, but I'll tell you how to add a script, install a database, whatever. And most of this stuff you can learn really quickly based on existing information on the web. How do you think I learn about this stuff? I've been investigating something called JSON, J-S-O-N recently. Did I take a class? No classes in JSON yet. But you go out, you do a Google search, you find some examples, you play with a little code, right, and you just spend the afternoon or whatever, and you learn it, and then you have it. And so when you need it, you don't need to go through a hiring process, you just quickly do it. Learn as you need to. Learn things as you need to.
So we're at the end time. I want to really thank the panelists. It's been a fantastic discussion. You guys have been great. And thank all of you for your